Good evening, everyone. You've tuned in to Paradigm Shifters, and oh, I think you're going to have such a good time with our guest tonight, whose name is Rizwan Virk. And Rizwan is the author and the one who lived through the magic of Zen entrepreneurship. Welcome to the show, Riz.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
I really love the fact that your search for becoming an entrepreneur, because of synchronicities or because of like the real messages of your life, you met some amazing spiritual beings. It's just, well, you call yourself a career warrior, right?
Yeah, that's right. And,
why don't you give everybody the thumbnail of how you got started? You were 23 or something, and you wanted to do your own business, and what happened?
Right. So I was just graduating from MIT, and I had grown up as a middle class family in Detroit, and I had graduated and had a lot of school loans, from college, and I wanted to start my own software company. And to be totally honest, I didn't really care too much about all the spiritual stuff. I just wanted to make some money and
you're allowed to say that. That's great.
And be successful, right? And then a series of encounters happened, which made me kind of question how separate these two worlds were. I began to learn about meditation. I began to learn about using your work as meditation. I think in most of our minds, these worlds are seen as very, very separate things. I mean, there's a scene in the book where I was at a software startup called Diva just before I started my own company, and this guy wandered in a suit and said, hey, we're running meditation classes next door, and, we're about using your work as meditation. And one of my coworkers, who knew a lot more about meditation than I did, kind of laughed it off and said, "That's silly. Meditation is about going off and giving up your worldly possessions and and reaching for enlightenment, not doing being in the business world and not being successful and making money. Those are like two totally separate things."
Right. That's actually the crux of the belief structure in there, isn't it, for a lot of people?
Yeah, it really is. There's this image that we have that you have to. You can't be one. You can't be both. You have to be one or the other.
Right.
And so what I found was, as I learned about this technique from a mentor of mine who's mentioned in the book, his name is James. Then he introduced me to his teacher, who in the book is called Ramaswamy.
So are you the only one that went to the meditation group?
That time I was. that specific time I went, and I was the only one at that time.
Great.
In that class. And so
great.
I had kind of a lot of personalized instruction. There were other people studying with him at the time. And then what happened was, as I grew my software startup, we did pretty well. We had millions of dollars in sales and thousands of customers around the world. At some point, the business ran into some problems and kind of ran into a wall. And it was only upon reflection and interacting with my teachers that I realized that these issues were the same issues that I was facing in my meditation and personal growth.
Hmm.
It was as if what was happening in the company was a direct reflection of my own personality.
Hmm.
And what I mean by that is that, I'm the kind of guy that likes to jump into something, do it for a little while, and then I get bored, and then I want to move on to the next thing. And then I want to jump in and do that, all the time. And then I get bored of that, and then I want to jump to the next thing.
But you're ultimately very creative. So would you call that, what does he call that? Ramaswamy calls it the
Energetic pattern.
That's right. Yeah.
Love
that.
And exactly. And so that was my energetic pattern, was to, interact with the world in this way. And what was happening was that the company itself, we had one product that was pretty successful, and then pretty soon we decided to make another product, which was reasonably successful, and then we decided to have a services group, and then we acquired another product, and pretty soon we were doing way too many things for a small startup to really be successful.
Mm.
And so this, this is where I really began to realize that, the stuff about the inner world and the outer world being related was actually quite true. There's a great quote about dragons in ancient Chinese philosophy, and I think it applies really well to this idea of our energetic patterns. And the quote goes like this. It says that if you try to feed the dragon, if you try to confront the dragon directly, it will defeat you. If you ignore the dragon, it will eat you or feed upon you.
Mm.
But if you learn to ride the dragon, then you can take advantage of its might and its power.
Oh, wow.
And our energetic patterns are like that. There's might and power in them. I mean, this is one of the reasons why I became an entrepreneur, was because I was creative and I like to jump into things and learn all about them. But it was also what was holding me back in that specific example, you know, from being a more successful entrepreneur.
So instead of being flexible or creative, you were being ending things and changing things?
Yeah, that's right. I was always moving on to the next thing. And so that became, you know, part of the struggle in that specific company. And so the idea of the book and the lessons throughout the book is that what we encounter, the challenges that we face, you know, are very much tailored to our own issues. You know, if we can learn to deal with those issues, we can also take advantage of the contribution, you know, that we're here to make to society as a whole.
Well, so was James real, and was Ramaswamy real, the people that were kind of your teachers along the way?
So they were based on real people, but as in most books, so what I've done is I've taken some of the teachings of the actual persons that both those characters were based on, mm-hmm. And as well as, you know, teachings that I've learned from other folks and other teachers that I've had, there's been quite a few, and I've put them all together kind of into this single narrative. So Ramaswamy, who was based on a real person, was actually a compilation of several teachers that I had over this period of time.
Mm. So what about the bilocating? Did that ever, or was that bilocating, or was that kind of attracting synchronistically? What I'm talking about is, in the book you talk about meeting him on the Pacific Coast Highway in a synchronistic event where you traveled a long way and suddenly your teacher's right there with you.
That's right, yeah. So there's a chapter in the book, you know, where I was living in Boston at the time, and so most of the book takes place in the Boston area, and I had taken a trip out to the West Coast, which is where I live now, actually, in California. You know, I went out to the Pacific Coast Highway, and there started to have these experiences where I was starting to, I was getting messages from what seemed like the ocean.
Oh, you're channeling the ocean. That's a big job.
Yeah. and you know, I was kind of skeptical about this stuff, so I thought, okay, that's weird. Maybe I need to get over to my hotel. And you know, in the book, Ramaswamy actually shows up at that point in the Pacific Coast Highway. And somehow he knows that I've been interacting with the ocean. And so, you know, in the book, it's not made clear what, I mean, he talks about an energetic link between, at that time in the 90s, Boston was a big center for high-tech entrepreneurship, and so was the San Francisco Bay Area with Silicon Valley. And so he used to travel back and forth a lot. And so, you know, it's one of those things I think readers will have to read.
No, I love it, because what it reminded me is, like, you're talking about these energetic projections? What are they called?
Patterns, the energetic patterns.
Yes, so those things stick out of us in a sense and kind of create scenarios, do they not? Or they create limitations, or they bring them to...
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, I kind of view it as, you know, if you have, like, I'm thinking of the old Play-Doh that I used to play with as a kid.
Right.
And there was this thing where you could have it go through a plastic pattern, like a star, and come out like a star on the other side.
So you can get really flummoxed by being in those patterns and not breaking out of them, right?
Yeah, and oftentimes it's very difficult to see that, you know, that it's our patterns that are causing some of what's happening to us. And I think seeing clearly is one of the big challenges that we have when we're caught inside our lives and we're in the middle of these patterns, and that's where meditation and yoga can really help.
I mean, and how long did it take you to get to break into your own patterns?
Well, you know, it took me a while to really see it, right? And then, you know, you can deal with it, I think, relatively quickly, or it can take many years, and it really depends on your state of mind and your state of openness.
Mm-hmm.
And as I was saying earlier, this is where meditation and yoga as practices can help us. If you look at the old yogic traditions, they talk about the mind and the body being a series of clear bubbles, or sheets, they call them, one inside the other. And that what happens as we go through life is we develop imperfections, which in Sanskrit are called samskaras, in these sheets. Mm-hmm. And I kind of like to view it as, you have these clear bubbles, and they start to get muddy, and they start to get all these little, you know, things on them, and then they start being bent out of shape. And then what happens is the light, which was flowing freely through when they were clear, doesn't go so freely through. It gets bent, right, because of our patterns and the light going out. So we don't perceive. It's kind of like driving on a rainy night with a muddy windshield, let's say. And so we don't always see, can't exactly see what's happening. We think we know what's happening. But when you start to clear off the windshield, and as you start to clear some of these imperfections, because the sum of these imperfections, you add them up, and that adds up to our specific pattern. It's the way we're holding our energetic field and the way that in which we interact with the world.
Mm-hmm. It's our karma and our personality and all that stuff rolled into a ball, is it?
That's exactly right, yeah. Mm-hmm. So it's our karma, whether it's from this life or previous lives. It's how we've reacted to things in the past. And, you know, what's interesting to me is that the more that I work with people. So the book is not just for entrepreneurs. It's really for anyone who's, you know, looking to make a change in their lives.
Oh, I think it's a terrific book. I think it's just well organized and really step by step.
Well, thank you. Yeah. And so, you know, what I've started to do myself is, you know, in this book, which takes place in the 90s, it was during my very first startup. And since then, I've become an investor and advisor to dozens of other entrepreneurs and their companies. And sometimes I'll start to see the same patterns repeating themselves. And so that's why...
In yourself, you mean?
In myself, but also in them. As you know, when I'm an investor and advisor to an entrepreneur or a company, I can kind of see what's happening sometimes more clearly than they can themselves, because they're in the middle of it, just like I was, you know, in the book in my very first startup.
Well, so jump into this whole thing about clues, because you talk right near the beginning about having clues that help us break into our energetic patterns, right?
Yeah. So, you know, one of the metaphors that that is used in the book is this idea that we're on a treasure hunt, right? And if you think back to the old Indiana Jones films, right, from the 80s, I don't know if you've ever seen those.
Oh, yeah.
But there's usually a spiritual treasure, whether it's the Ark of the Covenant or the Holy Grail, that they're trying to find. Right. You know, unfortunately, they can't get there right away. They're not shown the exact location. It'd be nice if there was a map that went straight there. But usually what they got was one clue at a time. And when they follow the first clue, it led to the second clue. And then when they follow the second clue, it led to the third clue. And so if we think of our spiritual treasure as being, you know, that part of us that wants to be successful, not just in a financial sense, but in a sense of being in the right place at the right time.
Mm-hmm. And being true to yourself as well.
Yeah, true to yourself, being aligned with your purpose and your mission, then these clues can help us to get there. And there's a lot of different types of clues. They're happening all the time. If we can learn to pay attention, you know. And I define a clue as something that evokes a certain feeling in our minds. It could be a coincidence. The best type of clue is what Jung called a synchronicity.
Right.
And it's when you're thinking about something internally, and then something happens in the outside world that correlates with what you've been thinking about. But there's no logical causation between the two. They just sort of happen at the same time, or close to the same time. The simplest example of this is you're thinking about a friend that you haven't thought about in a while, and then suddenly they give you a call when you haven't talked to them in a few years, for example, right? That's an outer event and an inner event kind of coinciding.
Right.
And so that's the first type of clue, and there's a lot of different types of clues. But usually, you know, they involve some element of a feeling that you have that either this is important or this is unusual. And they could contain a message for us. Oftentimes, they indicate a direction, you know, that we can go in our lives. I'll give you, here's a great example. A friend of mine a few years ago was trying to buy a house in Arizona, and this was before the housing bubble burst in 2008. And she had looked at literally dozens of places and couldn't find one that she wanted to buy. And she was getting kind of down because, I mean, this was during a bull market. Everybody was finding homes that they wanted to live in, and people were buying things, and mortgage rates were low. And, you know, she was driving along the road one day, and she saw this bumper sticker on a car in front of her. And the bumper sticker said, you know, "Not all those who wander are lost." And this car stayed in front of her for like half an hour, so she couldn't quite miss that clue.
Oh, wow.
And then she went home and she was browsing the internet, and somehow on some random website she saw the same phrase again, you know, not all those who wander are lost. And she came to me and she said, you know, I keep seeing this phrase, you know where it's from. I said, well, I think it's actually from a poem in The Lord of the Rings, which says that not all that is gold glitters and not all those who wander are lost. But she wasn't even a fan of science fiction or fantasy books. It was clearly a message that was tailored for her about her home search. And she got that message, and she said, okay, you know, maybe I shouldn't worry so much about buying a place. It's okay to rent and continue to move around. Mm-hmm. And it turns out, you know, later when the housing bubble burst, she decided she didn't even want to live in Arizona, and so it was a good thing that she didn't have a mortgage there, otherwise she would have been forced to stay there.
Wow. But then to receive that clue with confidence, that's difficult, isn't it?
So that's, you know, a skill that we can all develop, right? It goes on. The more that we notice these clues, the more that we will notice these clues. So it's about opening up your perception to things that seem unusual and things that repeat, mm-hmm. right? So in this case, you saw, you know, the message repeated once, twice, and actually I think it repeated even a third time, so she ended up seeing it like three times.
Wow.
That's when you know the clue's important, yeah. is when it repeats. So oftentimes people say to me, well, sometimes I have a hunch or an intuition, but I don't know if it's the right way to go. You know, how can I figure out if it's a real clue or it's just, you know, my pattern reasserting itself? And I always say that clues indicate a direction. Mm-hmm. It's still up to us to go in that direction.
Mm-hmm.
So the two rules of clues are, one, if it's unusual or leaves you with an unusual feeling, like a feeling of deja vu.
Mm-hmm.
And then second, does it repeat itself in some way? And it could just be that it sticks in your mind again and again, or it could be that you actually see an external thing that reminds you, you know, of that again and again.
So we don't miss things if you don't get them right away, huh?
That's right. Yeah, we don't miss things. And I always encourage people to take a half step to say, okay, if this, in fact, is the right direction for me to go in, then why don't I start in that direction without going all the way and then see what happens? It could be a simple thing. Like the other day, a few months ago, I had a dream with a friend of mine appeared, and I hadn't seen her in years. So I ended up just sending her an email the next day, right? So I took the half step in the external world and said, hey, how's it going? I haven't talked to you in a while. And she got back to me and said, oh, you know, I've been meaning to contact you because I'm entering this business plan competition, and I really need to get your feedback on this business plan. Right? And so that was a case where, you know, I took a little half step in that direction and found there was actually something there, that it wasn't just a random, you know, coincidental
thing. So you're
saying
validate those clues, right?
That's right. Validate the clues. And I think each of us has our own personal GPS,
mm-hmm.
right, if we can learn to pay attention to it. And that means that each of us gets clues in different ways. And if we can validate these clues, we can start to build our own navigational system that says, you know, for me, if I have a funny feeling in my head, right, that has proven to be a more valid indication that this is a real clue than if I just see something and have a feeling of deja vu, right? So I'm
mm-hmm.
just using random examples here, but if you learn to pay attention, you know, you can start to validate the clues and go in the direction.
Was it fun for you?
I'll give you another example.
Did it take you a lot of years to be able to be really flexible and fluid with this?
Yes, it did. I mean, I'd like to be able to say, you know, I got it right away. But I think like all of us, you know, I'm trained as an engineer, right? So oftentimes, you know, I'm looking for more obvious cause and effect. And the main thing about synchronicity, as Jung defined it, is that there is no logical cause and effect. But of course there is. You know, there's this higher pattern sometimes at work in our lives that we can't see while we're going through it. And I view these clues as kind of glitches in the matrix, right? To use another science fiction analogy, where things aren't going quite right. And so I think the more you pay attention to them, it's like any other muscle. The more you exercise that muscle, you know, the stronger it will become. And so now, you know, in the book, I recommend writing down clues.
Yeah.
Whether the clues come, you know, during the day, whether they come in our dreams. Anything that stands out, and then you can start to draw patterns. And, you know, I used to do that. I don't do that as much anymore because it's such an integrated part of my life that, you know, I'll be getting funny feelings all the time, and then I'll say, like, okay, I'll make a mental note that there's something indicating I should go in this direction, and then I'll just wait for the next clue to come along, And when it does, then I'll know that it's a good direction to investigate.
I love that. Well, so you started to say you're going to give us some examples when I redirected us briefly, so I'm ready.
Sure, yeah. So let me give you an example from my one of my startup companies. And this was a company after the one that I talk about in the book. We had started a company, again, in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and we couldn't figure out a name for our company. And so I was visiting my parents in Michigan for the holidays, and I happened to be driving by Ann Arbor, Michigan, which is the home of the University of Michigan, and there was this company name on a building right by the side of the freeway that really stuck out. And I looked at it, and it said the name of the company was called Arbor Text, and it just stuck in my head. And as I drove back to my parents' place, and then I flew back to Boston, it was one of those things that just kept coming up again and again. I had this funny feeling, and for me, that's a clue that this is a clue, is that sensation.
The funny feeling in you when you see it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. And so then I found out that company, you know, was actually in a similar market space to the space that we were in, and that they had started years ago. They named their company after their college hometown of Ann Arbor.
Oh.
And I said, okay, that's cool. Why don't we name our company after our college hometown of Cambridge? And so we were going to name it Cambridge Text, but we thought that was a little too close to Arbor Text, so we called it Cambridge Documents, which was close, but it was a name that we were all happy with, all three of us. And I thought, okay, well, that's an example where a funny feeling, you know, led to a suggestion, which then resolved an issue that I had been mulling over in my mind.
Mm-hmm.
But then I thought, okay, this clue isn't done. It was indicating a direction, and certainly we solved our initial problem of what do we name our company. So I did more research on the company, and then I contacted one of the founders of the company, just cold called by email. And he said, oh, yeah, sounds like what you guys are doing is interesting. So on the next holiday, when I was visiting my parents in Michigan, I went and showed him our new product. And we were just a small startup, like 3-4 people, and they were much bigger than us. And, you know, to make a long story short, they actually liked our product quite a bit. They became our biggest customer. And they got us into all kinds of companies that we would never have gotten into on our own, including like Boeing and Toyota and all these big companies.
Oh, wow.
And so, you know, that obviously took a while, and it had to make logical sense for them to want to work with us.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a kind of marrying intuition and logic here, right, together. I think that's a good formula for achieving success in life,
mm-hmm.
As it was for our company, was, you know, how do you marry these two so that you end up in the right spot, and then you end up, you know, doing the right things to move forward.
How long did it take you to turn your company into a viable company, you know, financially? You guys were working morning, noon, and night for a while, weren't you?
Yeah, we were. And so, it's different with each startup. We had a weird experience with that very first startup where right away the company started to make money pretty quickly, like in a couple months when we introduced the product. And then later, as we expanded and we hired more people and we raised millions of dollars in venture capital, then suddenly we were losing money again, right? So we went through these phases where we were profitable, sort of healthy, and then unprofitable, trying to expand. And so it kind of went back and forth for a while over the course of a few years.
And when you're losing money, did you have the strength, presence of mind and heart to stay looking at clues, to stay looking at energy patterns?
I believe I did, but, you know, it's always difficult, right, when you get into more stressful situations. But, yeah, I there's a scene at the end of the book that talks about, how the company had gotten really unprofitable, and I needed to figure out, you know, how to get it back to profitability. And that's where, you know, looking at the clues about the different things we were doing and trying to figure out, you know, what is the right the right thing to settle on and how to reallocate resources. And that happens a lot. It's happened to me in different startups where usually something works for a while. This happens in technology a lot, where some strategy works for a while and then something changes in the market and then suddenly that doesn't work anymore. So now you need to find a new business.
Because there's constant change in technology anyway, isn't there?
Yeah, exactly, exactly. And
so
that's
like you have to get back on the dragon and ride like mad, hey?
That's right. Yeah, you've got to get back on the dragon. You've got to find the dragon again and then get back on it.
Yeah, I guess that's true. It feels like a void sometimes, probably.
Yep, that's right.
So do you have other, this is very exciting. I mean, I really love your approach. Were you pretty courageous about going through those dips and swirls or?
Yeah, I mean, I can say it's always tough when you go through, you know, one of those situations. But then oftentimes it can help make you stronger, you know, for the next situation. And technology companies have a high failure rate, so I think it's a little more tolerated. Now I live in Silicon Valley, in Palo Alto, California, and you know, companies are always cropping up and companies are always going out of business. And so even though you know, things not working out is generally accepted here, it's still very difficult, you know, when you're going through that, because you've not only brought yourself, usually you have other people that you've brought along on this journey with you, people whose jobs are at stake or investors who've put in a lot of money, you know, into the company. Mm-hmm. And so it can be very stressful. And again, that's where I think having some practice where you can calm your mind regularly, whether it's meditation, yoga, or going for a daily walk, you know, out in nature somewhere, that where you feel afterwards like you've cleared your mind, is important. And being able to identify causes and effects and seeing clearly is very important. And then knowing yourself is very important as well, because sometimes, you know, you may find that you don't like this situation, but also that, you know, your heart is yearning to do something else. And so maybe the situation isn't working out because you're forcing yourself to do X, because X is supposed to be make money, but your heart is yearning to do something else. And so that's another possibility that we have to embrace when we go through these kinds of difficult
periods. I love the phrase career warrior.
Yeah, you know, that's an interesting phrase, and I used it for many reasons, but one of the reasons why was that if you go back to medieval Japan, you know, where Zen first was introduced, it was adopted by the samurai and by the warrior. And there was this class of kind of warrior monks, if you will, because they found that being in a certain state of mind helped them actually perform better, whether it was their swordsmanship or archery or certain arts in the world. And so, you know, the career warrior is meant to embody this idea that certain states of mind, you know, whatever they are, however you get to them, whether they're associated with Zen or some other tradition, that they can actually help you to be more effective and more courageous with your actual work that you're here to do. There's a great bit by the poet Rumi, and in the Sufi traditions, they talk very much about how we come into this life where we're kind of like an emissary sent by, you know, one king to another country to go deliver a message or do some task. But then when we get to that other country, we get so lost in the sights and the sounds, the hopes and the fears mm-hmm. of what's going on, that we lose ourselves and we forget why we were there in the first place.
Weapons of mass distraction.
Yeah, that's right. There's mass distraction, and there's so many distractions going on. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, part of this path is to try to get clear, try to get rid of the distractions, and try to remember that which we are here to do in the first place. And that is what we call, at the end of the book, we talk about the warrior's path, which is the unique contribution of lessons that we're here to learn. And the lessons very much relate to our energetic patterns and our karma. But not just lessons, combining the lessons we're here to learn with the contribution that we're here to make.
I love
that.
We
each have different mm-hmm. skills, and we each have different affinities and things that we're good at. And it's when we follow, you know, those abilities to actually accomplish things. I think that's an important part of our lives here as well. So the warrior's path, finding your warrior's path and walking it, really is about the combination of those two things. If you can find that combination, you know, then you're in the right place at the right time. And that's how I like to define success.
Well, and this book is written like an instruction manual in many ways for a person to find their warrior path, right?
Yeah, that's right. So, you know, the book is a story, but the story contains lessons, and then at the end of each chapter there are summaries and exercises to do to help find, you know, your own unique path and delve into your own strengths and weaknesses.
Well, tell me this, Rizwan, do you have most of your employees, I mean, have you through the years taught them to research their own, like, energy patterns and their own dharma?
Well, sometimes. I mean, so the terms that, you know, I use in the book and that we're talking about here aren't always terms that are well-known or accepted.
Acceptable, yes.
In the business world, you know. Mm-hmm. even in the technology world where, you know, we have many innovative startups. And so I tend to use different terminology, I think, in when I'm dealing with employees than I might in a spiritual book, although, you know, many of them, you know, have read the book. And there, you know, we talk about, you know, how people have different tendencies and different skill sets, and they tend to gravitate towards those. And so by examining where they've gone in the past, we start to get into this idea of the external pattern. Mm-hmm. So we talked about the energetic pattern, which is our internal, you know, sum of all our karma and other things. But that usually manifests itself in external patterns. And the way to recognize that is to reflect on things that have happened. You know, again, it gets back to this idea of repetition. Mm-hmm. If something has happened three times in your life, then you can say that it's a real pattern. Mm-hmm. And if it's happened that many times, then, you know, there's something going on here that it's not just random, right? Mm-hmm. And, I often use it to look, for example, when I'm hiring an employee. I remember, I think it was last year. So over the years, I've interviewed many potential employees. And sometimes
and you're still young.
And sometimes it's not gone so well. And I remember last year, I was interviewing a guy, and I looked at his resume, and you know, it looked like he was leaving each company in under a year. So I asked him, well, what happened at this first startup? And he said, oh, those guys were idiots. They didn't know how to market the product. They didn't agree with me. So I decided to leave. I thought, okay, then, you know, that could happen, right? There's a lot of people that don't know what they're doing in the startup world. But then I said, what about the second company? And he told the story, and then eventually it got to the point where he said, well, you know, they didn't really listen to me. They weren't marketing the product wrong. They were just idiots, and so I left. I said, okay, that's twice. And then the next company, the same thing happened, right? What he said, you know, I didn't agree with them. I had a disagreement with them. They didn't know what they were doing. I knew what I was doing, and I left. And I thought, okay, there's a pattern, right?
Yeah.
So this guy didn't even realize that he was going through this pattern of his own making in many ways, right? There was something about his energetic pattern that was causing him to get into these disagreements with pretty much everybody he worked for. And so, you know, I talked about it with our hiring managers and our employees, and I said, you know, 6 months from now, he'll be at the next interview telling them what idiots we were, how he didn't agree with us. And it's not that we can't change our patterns. We can. It's just that these are our tendencies, and if we're not conscious about it, which most people aren't, then we end up repeating, you know, the same issues again and again. And for that guy, you know, we ended up not hiring him. And for him, again, this maybe it was a strength in his own way where he wanted to be really independent, and he was, you know, off doing some independent contracting, and that was probably a better life for him than to join companies full time,
mm-hmm.
you know, because of the way his pattern was. And so, you know, maybe there was a successful strategy there for him to deal with his pattern.
But I think that's really an interesting story, actually. So there's something also I'm kind of musing here. What about the group energy patterns? Do you work in that? You know what I mean? Like a whole company which has a kind of negative attitude. We hear about that sort of
thing. Yeah. I mean, you know, it's very interesting that when you go into different companies, you know, you will get a completely different feeling.
Like they have a personality of their own, even though there's many
people.
Yeah,
there's like this bigger group personality, right,
yeah.
That goes beyond the individual personalities. And so, you know, that's kind of what ends up being the informal company culture, right? I mean, there's always a formal company culture, right? These are the things that we do. This is when we all have company outings, blah, blah, blah. Like, these are the type of meetings we have. There's the formal stuff, but I think somehow the informal stuff is even more interesting, and every group of people will form, you know, their own patterns like this, and usually it's a reflection of the personalities and patterns of multiple people, and it'll usually start with at the top, but then it'll filter its way down.
But it's kind of attraction, isn't it? Is all the people being attracted because they have similar energy patterns?
Yeah, that's right. And then the people that don't fit in will sort of sense it after a while, right? So like in my current startup, I have a new startup now, and, you know, we're often online talking to each other on messaging on IM on Skype at like, you know, 11 p.m. or midnight, right? And probably more decisions get made, you know, at that point than they do actually during the day.
That sounds like the techie world to me.
Yeah, but there are guys, you know, for whom that's not an ideal situation, right? And so
right.
They don't really fit into that world very well. Anybody who likes to get up really early, you know, go to the office by 7 or 8 a.m., right? None of us are there. So it doesn't really work, right?
Well, so what about, I mean, this is kind of like a deeper, more intricate form of manifesting, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And you know, in the book, I talk about manifestation and the four keys of manifestation, you know, which I learn about, you know, from my teacher. And I think too often, you know, we are so focused on only one of those keys of manifestation.
Can you list them for us?
Yeah, sure. So let's start with the first one, which is, I think, the one that most people at least are familiar with the techniques of, which is what I, in the book, I call right intent. And that is about setting your intent on a specific goal and visualizing it and trying to bring it into reality. And you know, there's the law of attraction. There's, you know, you go back to creative visualization in the 70s. It was a very popular, but going all the way back to Napoleon Hill in the 20s. Talking, you know, in his book, Think and Grow Rich. And so there's this idea that if you visualize something, you can bring it into reality. But I was talking to someone the other day, and they said, you know, too often people think of the universe as like this big ATM machine, right? It's just like, give me $50,000, give me a new house, give me this, give me that, right? And I think, you know, too often it's presented that way, that we can just ask for anything and it'll come to us. But I actually think that in choosing, in setting your intent, it's important to learn to listen and to find the right image and let the image come to you. And so there's a couple ways of thinking about manifestation. One way is, you know, you choose X and therefore you steer, you know, through the power of your willpower and tapping in the universe, you steer there. The other way of thinking about it is, and I think it's a very interesting way, is that there are all these probable realities and probable futures out there. And some are more probable than others. And if we can learn to tap into those futures, we can find the one that's ideal. And so then it's not just simply a matter of creating the future as much as steering towards the one that we want.
And they come through your intuition or dreams?
Yeah, and that comes through your intuition. And so that's why it's important not just to choose any old image that you're visualizing and manifesting, but really to let the image come to you. So it's not always about projecting out. You know, I studied for a little while with this woman, Barbara Brennan, who wrote Hands of Light. Mm-hmm. And she talks a lot about the energy field and the chakras. And, you know, she talks about how when we're projecting, our third eye chakra actually goes outwards and it rotates one way. And when we're listening and taking in things, it rotates the other way. And I thought that was an interesting way to think about it.
That is interesting. But,
so listening and perceiving and using your intuition is as important as projecting. You know, we live in a very externally focused world, right? In the West, right? Everything is about going out and doing things, and this is what you need to do. And sometimes you need to not do anything. You need to let things come to you. And so that is the kind of the twist on the first key of manifestation that I think is really important that people don't always talk about.
Right. I really like that. That answers the thing of, like, sometimes things are meant to, I mean, I'm quite conscious of the fact that people are going around creating in their mind, but there are a lot of things meant to come to them. So you've just explained that in a really great way.
Yeah. I mean, sometimes, you know, somebody will manifest something without doing any of these exercises, any of these techniques, right?
Yeah.
They were just tapping into that timeline to get to that probable future. And you know, this is tying into quantum mechanics a lot. In quantum mechanics, they talk about a probability wave, right, with all these future events. Mm-hmm. And it's not until certain choices are made that the probability wave collapses into a specific future.
Right.
And, you know, so there's a different way of looking at it. And I think it's a very interesting model.
It's a very dynamic model, actually.
Yeah.
In terms of your
being. So then the second key of manifestation that I talk about in the book is related to what we were talking about earlier, which is our patterns. So it's right patterns, and it's understanding, you know, how your energetic patterns are affecting your ability to manifest. And this is why I always encourage people to reflect on what has happened in the past. And the past doesn't have to repeat in the future, but unless we're conscious of it and change things, it often does.
Mm-hmm.
And so we can look at what we've manifested in both good and bad in our lives and say, you know, why was it so easy to manifest this thing, but this other, you know, thing that we wanted to didn't happen, and instead we got something worse. And so understanding our own patterns is important in choosing the third key of manifestation, which I call the right technique. And so this is choosing a path of action to go and achieve your goal. And I usually like to say, it's not that there aren't enough techniques out there. The problem is that there are too many techniques, right? Mm-hmm. Whether you want to be successful in the stock market or in real estate or, in the film industry.
But we use it to judge ourselves. I think that's a big problem, too, you know.
What's that?
We often use our manifestation. We use those styles and techniques to judge one another.
Yes, that's right. That's right. We do. Yeah. And we use it to kind of look at where we are and compare ourselves to others. But I think the important thing is to find the right technique for us, given our energetic patterns.
Mm-hmm.
I'll give you a perfect example. A number of years ago, I went to see a famous author in Berkeley. I think it was Isabel Allende, who's mm-hmm. pretty well known for some of her fictional works. And somebody asked her, well, how can I write my first novel? And she said, well, here's a technique. Write a page a day, every day, and then at the end of the year, you'll have 365 pages. And that's enough material for a novel. Huh. And I thought, what a great technique. So I went home and I tried it. And you know what? After a few weeks, I found that I totally failed at that technique.
Oh, you did?
It didn't work for me because my energetic pattern wasn't the slow and steady, this is how you get things done. It worked well for her, and I'm sure it worked well for many other people.
Mm-hmm.
I was the kind of guy who could write 5-10 pages in a day and then write nothing for 2 weeks,
right?
and then write another chapter, and then write nothing for a month, and then write 3 chapters. And so, my energetic pattern was very different. And so I think oftentimes we're too busy trying to duplicate other people's success
mm-hmm.
and not tapping into our own abilities and our own natural ways of manifesting. And if we can learn to do that, then we can be more successful at what we were meant to do in this life.
Well, it's funny because people say, it's not all about you, and I go, well, actually it is, because I'm the only one who can study what it is I'm doing to get in the way, or whatever.
That's right. That's right. Exactly. And then finally, the fourth key is what I call right timing or appropriateness.
Mm-hmm.
This gets into our inner timing mm-hmm. and our karma and what we were meant to do. Again, tying back to that idea of listening and perceiving what futures are out there for us. And the external timing of the market. Sometimes, like I'm in the tech industry, and a few years ago I built a very successful company in the iPhone game app space, and apps were new.
Mm.
And it was the external timing of the market. It was relatively easy to do. Not that it was easy, but it was easy when you have a new market that's expanding.
Mm-hmm.
It's like the old saying that a rising tide lifts all boats.
Mm.
Now,
nice.
If I were to do an app company today, which I am actually doing another, I find that it's much more difficult, right?
Mm.
Because there are 900,000 apps in the Apple App Store. And so it's very difficult to really get yours to stand out.
Mm-hmm.
And so the timing of the market for anything that we're trying to do in the world is very important. And then getting back to our personal timing, our inner timing is really important as well. It may be something we were called to do, but the timing may be off. And how can you, figure that out? Well, that's where the clues come in to be handy. Because the more you can tap into clues, the more you can sense, the right timing for something. And it may not be the timing that your mind says, so it may not all be about logic. It may be more about following your intuition.
It may be just because you want it right now. It's not going to work right now, right?
That's right, and I think that's often the problem, right?
But there's something interesting about these days that it's really tricky out there right now, and do you think it still all works then?
Do I think manifestation still works?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I think if you boil down, this idea of manifestation, it gets down to that old biblical saying of ask and ye shall receive, right? But sometimes we ask and we don't receive, at least not right away.
At least not right away.
And I think that's happening more and more. But I think that's because we aren't viewing the broader pattern at work. Right? We aren't tuning into that there may be a larger pattern. There may be a right timing for things, which is not the timing that we want,
I know, that's kind of interesting. I'm also aware that entrepreneurs through time are known to be kind of courageous, and they go up and down with the fields of change on the planet anyway. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. And I think, during downturns, there's... it's when people are trying to be more conservative, sometimes that's not a bad time to be an entrepreneur, because then you can get something started, but you have to be a little courageous and go out there and put yourself on the line in your finances. But it has to be right for you. And I always tell you know, I used to always encourage people who wanted to be entrepreneurs to go and start their business. And now I don't always encourage them to do it right away. I say, you know, wait until the point of no choice. Mm. Then you will have.
Well,
right,
what's the
time.
Point of no choice look like?
And so the point of no choice is an internal point. Mm-hmm. It's about internal timing. And it's when you have spent enough time thinking about something and you've investigated all the possible avenues and you've tried to go some other route and you can't. Internally, you've kind of built up this momentum. It's like, oh my God, I got to do this now, otherwise I'm going to miss out on this opportunity, right? And after a while, you have no choice but to follow your passion and to follow. Now, that's different than saying, you know, when you first think of an idea, you may think it's interesting, but you may not know enough about the market to know, you know, whether that first idea will be successful or if you have to modify it. And so I encourage people to spend the time, put in the time and the energy, even while they're doing something else, mm-hmm. right? They may have a regular job and experiment with this at night. And then at some point, if the momentum builds to the point where it's clear to you that you have to do this full time, then that's the right time to jump in.
Hmm. And if nothing's going on, it's better to meditate, right?
Yeah, exactly. Sometimes it's better to just step back and, you know, not do anything and wait for the clues to guide you, right?
Yeah, and tell me a little bit more about the energy patterning. I think that's just a real crux of people getting out of their own repeated problems, you know, kind of thing. Can you tell us how to
Yeah,
release that?
Yeah, I think it very much is, and because... You know, the energetic pattern is very much the sum of our hopes and our fears, but it also dictates how we react, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that's an important point, is that our reactions to things in the world are colored by our energetic patterns. So if we just react completely unconsciously without thinking about it, you know, we will react a certain way, which will eventually lead to similar decisions and similar results in the world around us. Mm-hmm. But if we can learn to take a deep breath, right, and say, you know what, normally I would do X mm-hmm. when this happens, but I'm not going to do X. I'm going to take a deep breath, and I'm going to wait until tomorrow, and then I'm going to decide whether to do X or not. We're disrupting the normal pattern, and usually these patterns, you know, they affect our decision making, but there's clues going on inside our body. There's sensations that we have. I was talking to a woman actually on a radio show, I think, over the summer, and she said she kept getting into these business arrangements with people, which seemed promising at first, and she'd get in the contract, and then something would go wrong, and then she wouldn't be able to get out of them. And this had happened multiple times.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, well, do you tend to jump into these business relationships quickly? And she said, yeah. I said, well, maybe the next time you're having a meeting with someone and they're proposing some business relationship and you get really excited about working with them, you notice the sensations of excitement in your body, right? Because that is what causes you to want to jump right in. And I know that sensation well because I like to jump into things quickly.
Mm-hmm. But have you stopped jumping into things quickly, like this lady? I mean,
Yeah. So I have. Over time, now I don't jump into things as quickly, you know. And what I will do is I will, again, take sort of a half step, and I will wait for the clues to indicate whether that's a direction to go into or not, right, rather than jumping in. And so, you know, I told her that she could take a deep breath and say to the person, this sounds like a good proposal, you know, let me think about it for a few days, and then come back in. So you can actually structure things in your life to deal with what you know and have learned about your energetic patterns.
So she can take a few days and look at her tummy and see how it's moving or that sort of thing.
Right, exactly. And then on a more practical level, she can also structure her business relationship so there's a 30-day out clause, right?
Oh.
And that says that in the first 30 days, I'll figure out whether we want to continue or not. And that, you know, I'm not suggesting everybody needs to do that for every business contract or relationship they get into, but for her, that would have been a good solution.
For somebody who recognizes that as an energy pattern. I have a client who has bought and sold a lot of homes, and it's always, always traumatic. Huge, big. And I'm just listening to you going, I'm going to talk to her about that, because it's just frustrating to watch and know that everybody's going to be in turmoil all the way through this.
Right. And if it's happened, you know, several times already.
Yeah.
You know, that's the external pattern, which is the reflection of some internal pattern, right? I mean, there are people who buy and sell homes without turmoil, right?
Exactly. Some just do it like it's greased, you know?
Yeah.
But I also know a lot of young people right now who are in their 20s and 30s who all have terrible father problems.
Hmm.
And I'm going, isn't that interesting? I know probably about 20, 25 of them, you know? And I'm going, I guess that would be a good way to get to that as well, because it turns them away from men or makes them afraid of men or put up with terrible men. You know what I'm saying?
Right. So it's influencing, right, what's happening in their lives.
Yes, it doesn't have to be just about business. It can be what you're writing about here. It can be about anything that...
Yeah, it really can be. And, you know, oftentimes, you know, I'll talk about repetitive patterns and people will remind me that, you know, certainly a lot of young people in relationships, right?
Yeah.
You'll see that they're, even though they're going out with different people, right, it's like the same relationship repeating over and over again.
And they feel it's relentless. They feel like that's their lot in life, a lot of them, you know?
Yeah, exactly. And you know, they can learn to kind of tune in to the decisions that they're making and disrupt the pattern as it's happening, right? And then eventually, if you do that enough, then your pattern starts to change, you know. I'm not nearly as impulsive as I was back in the days that I write about in the book. And I don't just jump into things so quickly anymore. You know, I've had a lot of different experiences since then. It's been 20-some years since the original startup. In fact, I think it was 93 was when I started that company that the book is about.
Yeah.
So it has been literally 20 years now.
Now, has it been fun?
Yeah, definitely. It's been great fun.
So, and before we end, what kind of stuff are you going to be doing next? Are you going to keep changing? Are you really happy with being an entrepreneur and a venture capitalist or whatever you are?
Yeah, so, you know, what I've done over the years is I've started to see that my own personal mission in life has become to help others can achieve their dreams and bring their visions into reality. And so one of the ways I've been doing this is as an angel investor in startups, but you know, another way that I've gotten very interested in lately is independent film projects. And so I've become a producer and an investor in a number of different independent films, and that's a different way.
Well, that's an exciting field, isn't it?
Yeah, it's kind of fun. I mean, this is sort of the world of independent film, which is a little bit different than the Hollywood studios,
mm-hmm.
but it's usually somebody has an idea and they want to bring this idea to reality and they need help and they don't know how to get there, or they need money, or they need something. And so I'm sort of trying to apply some of what I've learned.
Well, that's exciting, because with all the media access that we all have, even with our own computers and iPhones and all that, it's a whole different field now, isn't it?
It really is, especially with new media. I mean, you can make a film, release it online, you know, never having gone through any kind of traditional distribution system.
Yeah.
And get it out to a group of people that want to see it. And so I think that's pretty exciting.
I'm very, very excited for you. And I sort of laugh. I go, yeah, because films actually have their own energetic force field that comes out there as well, don't they?
They really do, yeah. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, oftentimes the making of the film has its own kind of energetic pattern that comes into play.
You're so interesting. Tell people how to get hold of you, and what would they get hold of you for? Making a film, starting a business,
sure,
buying your book, which the book is tremendous, you guys.
Yeah, so that's a good start. And so you can go to my website at www.zenentrepreneur.com. And from there, there's links to Amazon. There's a link to my blog, where I'm usually writing about random topics, ranging from spirituality to startups to science fiction.
I love it. Mm-hmm.
Yep. And there's also some contact information there as well.
Great. Oh, this has been, I just feel like I'd like to ask you a billion questions about all your learning curves. Your learning curve has been very, what did you say? You love to jump in and out. You love to keep changing. Well, you're doing that. You're actually being the one who's actually that, right?
That's true. Yeah, I have been doing that.
I'm really impressed. It's very exciting. By the way, also, do you have any children?
No, I don't have any children. But recently, my brother and his wife had their fourth child. It was their fourth boy. So I have four nephews that keep all of us in the family pretty busy.
Can you give, I guess what I keep thinking is it would be really nice to teach children to understand some of the basics of this sort of thing. I know they don't want to rush off and meditate yet, but, you know.
Yeah, that's right. But, you know, sometimes physical yoga is interesting to children more than meditation, right?
Well,
because, you know, each of the poses, you know, there's like the tiger pose and the lizard pose, right? It's kind of fun to a play, you know, in pretending you're these animals while you're doing these poses, and that's not a bad way to get them started.
No, and they can really tune into that kind of, they can tune into the dragon.
That's right. There you go.
Good for you. Well, this has really been fun for me. Thank you so much for being a paradigm shifter. You've made a difference on the planet already, and you're still young, Rizwan.
Well, thank you very much. And thanks for having me on the show.
Oh, it's just been a delight. And thank you all for listening. And I hope you enjoyed it like I did. This is Veronica Entwistle saying, if you have any feedback, hit the Ask Veronica button on my website, veronicaentwistle.com, or check out Rizwan Virk's zenentrepreneur.com. And thank you again for being a wonderful guest.
You're welcome.
Good night.